For April 15th, 2024, it's the Overthinking It Podcast, episode 824, an Ozempic in search of an Olestra. Welcome to Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. I don't know why I paused there. I've done this so many times. 824. This is my 824th time reading the intro. And yet it's new every time. Am I even reading the intro? Is any of this real? We are the Overthinkers and we are your smart, funny friends from the internet. I'm Matt Rather. I'm here with my friends, Pete Fenzel. Hello, Pete.
Hey, Matt, they know it's real because the cadence of your voice is more elaborate than any AI system would bother to reproduce.
Sure, yeah.
It has a real melody to it. It goes up, 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 and down, down, down. It's all over the place.
It goes up in the middle of the sentence and down at the end. And Mark Lee. Mark, welcome.
I don't know about you guys, but I'm pretty sure I've been hallucinating this whole podcast this entire time.
If we were in a podcast focused simulation, would anyone know? Would any of us actually know? I'm one of the robots. I'm just a figment of your imagination. No, we realize that we're disembodied voices, but each of us in our real lives has a body, and there are three of us. That makes us a three-body problem, because if this podcast is anything, it is not a three-body solution. I promise you that. I guess the three-body solution is like a hot tub if you put three bodies into it.
Anything can be a solution if the three-body solution if you put three bodies in it.
I guess, yes.
Three-body washing machine. Quick, they're coming. Put them in the washing machine.
Put the bodies in the washing machine.
Hey, what would be a three-body Star Trek solution to a three-body Wi-Fi problem?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. It's like an episode of The Sopranos where they're trying to hide three bodies, right? And I don't know, someone from Star Trek Discovery comes and is like, put them in the next generation. And then forget about it.
I think what you have to do, you would have to use the deflector array to change the mass of one to make two of the stars combine. Right. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Never mind.
Tony, boss, you've got to reverse the polarity of the underlying tachyon field.
Was that Christopher Walken guest starring in The Sopranos? That's pretty good.
Tony, you've got to. Yeah, I don't know. All my impressions end up sounding Russian after a while, and so I don't. Yeah. You know, I
but
try
you know
not
my
to.
Rule, you know my rule of accents, right?
It's all friends of Wario.
You show me yours, and I'll show you mine. They're all Wario. Oh,
yeah, as time approaches infinity, all accents approach Wario.
Oh, I feel like we've talked about this before. I used to play when I was
it's me, Wario. I was Scottish once, but now I talk like Wario. Once I was a vampire.
It's a Wario.
Now I talk like Wario.
Will you fight? No, we will run and we will live. You know, a day may come when the courage of men fails, but it is not this day. It's Wario. I'm a Wario. I'm going to win. For me, it's Sean Connery. They all approach Sean Connery at a certain thing. And back from my professional theater acting days, what I would do to amuse myself and fellow actors just for a month's long run, this did not get old. At least for me, it did not get old. Is that you say the other actor's lines, whoever is on stage right now and who you hear, you know, over the loudspeaker or whatever, you say them in the voice of Sean Connery, you know? So, if I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle shin is this, my lips, two blushing pilgrims ready stand to smooth their rough touch with a tender kiss. And, and then the other actors all do it. Everyone does things as Sean Connery. But is Sean Connery even real? I mean, that's a fourth body to add to our three body problem here. That's too many. It's too many. Anyway, I thought the three body problem was actually the film Bodies, Bodies, Bodies.
with Rachel Sennett. But the apparently it's a series of science fiction novels written by a Chinese science fiction writer, and now has been adapted into a Netflix documentary because it's
actually,
true.
Matt,
because
actually,
it's true. Because it's true science.
The series is called Remembrance of Earth Past. I believe. Three Body Problems is the first book. So like Game of Thrones, they named the series after the first book because that's what people know and they go looking for. Right? So the series isn't called Game of Thrones.
And it's been done, and it's being done by the Game of Thrones guys. So we know the quality is going to steadily decline.
Is that Sean Connery or Wario? I'm not sure.
The quality is going to steadily decline over the span of the show. But the first thing is out. Now I just want to be clear, we have not watched it.
I've seen most of it.
That's not true. Mark has watched it.
Mark has watched it.
Mostly.
Sort of. Most of it. Marcus watched it, short of most of it. But the Overthinking It podcast tradition, proud Overthinking It podcast tradition, that's not going to stop us from talking about something tangentially related to it. Mark, I'm given to understand that this television show involves a virtual reality. Is that the case?
Yeah, but before we get there, just really quickly, since it is made by the Game of Thrones guys, it does have nudity and gratuitous violence as well. So, you know, they're checking out those boxes, just, you know, in case you were worried that those two fine folk have lost their edge and gone soft. No, they have not.
Can I also just say one thing before we stop making jokes about the name of this show and move on to what it's actually about? When we were talking in the back channel, Belinky has not seen this show or is familiar with the book, and he was offering theories as to what he thought it was about. This is what I think it's about. And I told him, no, what it's about is it's about this college student who, due to a gypsy curse, every 8 hours, his body changes from being a nerd to being a jock to being like a yuppie, right? And he sort of rotates through these three different bodies, and he falls in love with three different co-eds, and he's trying to date all of them at the same time. And he never responded to that, so I'm kind of concerned he thinks that's what it's actually about. Probably not. But I did spend a lot of time on Bing Image Creator trying to make the movie poster for this 80s movie and left very dissatisfied by the current state of artificial intelligence and its inability to plot out young Jerry O'Connell vehicles were they to exist that never existed. But yes, that is not what the Three Body Problem is about. Sorry, Mark. Yeah, I'll hand it back.
Give it 3 years and I think Sora will just generate all that video for you.
Oh, yeah.
It's right on the corner. That would be pretty hilarious. I would watch that AI generated like middling 80s sex comedy. Just very slimmest amount of context, and then we'll get the thing we're actually talking about Three Body Problem, right? It is sort of about aliens, but at least for the salient part of this here, the aliens have somehow gotten into the world extremely advanced virtual reality helmets. And the first season of Three Body Problem, they do feature prominently, and they're the type of things where they're the technology is so advanced, it's not like what we have now with, like, you know, you got to put the big clunky goggles on and you've got some kind of motion tracking hand controls. No, the whole thing just kind of like hijacks directly into your brain and is completely 100% immersive in terms of, you know, full visual fidelity. You can smell, taste, feel, all that good stuff, you know, move around, you have full locomotion, all that good stuff. And this brought to me the occasion to propose to the group here to talk about this idea of immersive entertainment. The other thing that brought this to mind was seeing this ridiculous video of somebody watching the Masters Golf Tournament in their extremely expensive Apple Vision Pro headset. And they're sitting on their couch, and it's got the pass-through video, so you could argue how immersive this is or not, where, you know, you can see this person's living room and the dog just kind of moving around looking for attention, but there's also six video feeds of golf. Now, if you're not familiar with golf telecasts, of course, like, there's a lot of golfers playing at once, so this is actually quite useful. It's a good use case for something like this, where you've got like a bunch of different video feeds. You can kind of look around the room and you can choose what you're looking at, and you can look over and look at the big leaderboard that shows all, you know, the dozens of players, and or at least the top dozens or so players and their score in each hole. So, like, you know, there's like lots and lots of information to look around. it's cool, but it's also ridiculous. And then there's a kind of the broader, just general phenomenon of virtual reality entertainment that we have, and or not even like stepping back from virtual reality. Like I got this 34 inch, what's called ultra wide monitor for extra immersion in my video games. Right, you know, like I'm playing a flight simulator game, and I got like extra field of view, and I feel like I'm a little bit more in the cockpit, or maybe like I'm playing a first person shooter, and I've got a little bit of extra field of vision. You know, whereas the old monitor will only take up like. You know, however many degrees of it. Now I've got like that many degrees plus 25%. And like, I feel like I'm a little more inside of it. So I thought it'd be fun to talk about this idea of immersive entertainment, like what it is and why in particular is it desirable. So maybe just like kind of start off on the, let's just kind of like talk about this idea of virtual reality, right? Like the full headset kind of thing. Right. Have any of you done this?
Oh, never go full headset.
But no, but you should. I think it's actually kind of awesome. And I'm not here to just kind of like poo-poo the whole notion, you know, even though like, you know, watching the Masters on your Apple VR while your dog is begging for attention is kind of hilarious. But yeah, Matt, I gather understand you have not had this wonderful experience.
No, I've never done it. I have enough problem with motion sickness. I mean, less so recently, but I'm usually driving, I guess. But like whenever I'm a passenger in a vehicle, I always have a problem with motion sickness. And I understand that this is if you're susceptible to this, then the current set of VR headsets might not be for you.
It is fortuitous that we're having this podcast the week after our jet lag podcast. Because the concepts that underlie the problem of jet lag also underlie the problems of virtual reality, right? In that you have more than the ostensible degrees of sensation and awareness than are altered by your intervention.
Yeah, right? That is interesting. I mean, actually, this introduces, I think, an interesting thought technology, which is kind of the internal versus the external, right? Like the kind of the internal calibration versus the external calibration of the stimulus, right? And you can't, yeah, like as in jet lag, it's the light, right? The effects of light on the body that is the kind of the main thing operating there. But with this, it's what the stabilization of your inner ear or something like that. That kind of makes the whole thing work. I mean, I've not done the Apple one either. I've not like gone to the, I'm not going to buy one certainly. And I've not gone to the store and like had a demo of what it's like. That sounds like it might be fun, but I've not done it. I've not done a thing where you like put a thing and like what you surround yourself in rubber bands and like run on a treadmill that goes in all directions or something like that. I mean, what is this? Some kind of hologram deck, you know?
I mean, the one that I did in Vegas, and I'll share this experience and I'll turn it over to Pete to share his, which is that like the entire VR rig, you know, you wear the goggles, you've also got a gun because this is a shooting game, and then the computer itself is on a backpack that you wear, and then you can just like fully roam around an environment so that, you know, there is a rig, right, with the rubber bands and kind of a mat and a kind of a 360 treadmill thing, which is very clunky. But this is like you just walk around in the environment and it feels like you're walking around. And I would say it was incredible, right? This is the sort of thing where like if money and time and, you know, the confines of my apartment were no issue, like I would want this. Now all these things are an issue, I'm concerned frankly that if I got a VR headset and could play like, you know, my flying and other games on my computer, then that would be a major detriment to my functioning as an adult in a society, as, you know, as a worker and as a husband and a father, all those sort of things. So as much as I want it, and like I consider immersive entertainment to be something desirable, a goal to achieve, I know that I kind of have to keep it away from myself for me to be a healthy human being. That's kind of like, you know, like that my kind of the high mark there for me, the bar that I have, and I know that I must not approach it. Pete, do you have anything at all like a similar experience, relationship with immersive entertainments?
Yeah, I feel like I have a little bit of I have some perspective on it that's similar and some that's different. The one experience of modern VR that I've used, and I've used other VRs that are less modern. We all kind of know that there's been a release of a bunch of new stuff. Is I did play, I think it's called a mixed reality game on a Meta Quest 2. Mm-hmm. That was one of my sisters and my brother-in-law let me use over Christmas. And it is interesting for a bunch of reasons. One being that what you guys have both just described presents a design constraint on these sorts of entertainments or productions or kind of realities that might be created, right? In that you have to get gussied up like a Ghostbuster in order to move around an environment. Matt has talked about moving around an environment with like rubber bands, right? And also about motion sickness. Well, the answer here is that you don't move in the game. This was a game, I think, I don't know whether it was Alien Defense it was very straightforward game where you were standing in the middle of a room, the room that you were in, and aliens would start coming at you from all directions, and you had to like stun them and then put them in a bucket, right, into a little like collector, right? You had to kind of like, and you had a gun in each hand, and you had to kind of like turn them into bubbles and put the bubbles in the collector or something. It was very Ashley Judd in Next Generation, right? It was very much like do the thing with the shapes. And then gradually over the course of the game, you would shoot holes in your own walls, or the aliens would break through the walls, and you would reveal a 3D cartoonish alien landscape that extended in all directions. So you started out, you know, playing the game in the room with, and this was in 3D, right? So it's not just VR, it's also in 3D, although I guess those two things, should people think of those two things as synonymous? I feel like that's a leap that, you know, should be acknowledged as being part of the entertainment, because it felt like being in a 3D movie where the aliens are kind of 3D movie objects that are in the room with you, you know, which is
cool and awesome. But like,
it's not like mind blowing. It's not like anything super new. It's like, you know, I've seen Captain EO and that was a long time ago. And so like the sensation of being in the room with a 3D alien object was not like totally unheard of. But the way that it was designed and interacted with was, I think, kind of elegant. But I think, from what I've heard,
since you mentioned the word mind blowing, I will say that my experience was exactly that.
Mind blowing.
Yes, I was like drenched in sweat, and my heart was absolutely racing by the time I was done with it.
Well, amazing. Well, because you got to figure out what is it that you could actually use. I mean, I went to a bowling alley with my family a couple weeks ago, and we went to the video arcade there, where the arcade machines were all like way, way more stimulating than anything that I would have put in an arcade. I think it's because they want to justify charging you like $3 to play them or something. You know, like Space Invaders, but it's 20 feet tall with like a giant pixelated LED screen, right? Like,
yeah,
you know,
and a big physical gun noise that you can hold and shoot. Yeah.
I had to carry my screaming son out of the video arcade and put him forcibly into the car where he immediately took all his clothes off and peed himself. Like, it was a very disruptive and painful experience. Maybe I should have said that on the podcast, but it was like just merely being in this video arcade was extremely unpleasant.
But just to be clear, like, he was so hyped up and like into it that he did not want to leave it.
He both did not want to leave it and also could not decide which game to play and kind of shut down. Because he also couldn't handle the extreme violence that was everywhere, which we really, really, really didn't want him to see. But he was drawn to it. So it was sort of like he would want to go to this thing and it'd be like, no, you can't do that. You can't do this like game where you're shooting a bunch of guns at zombies and blowing their heads off. Right. Like, no, you can't go over there. Maybe you could do the Batman game. Oh, there's a bunch of terrorists trying to blow up a building. You know, and it's like all of this is too much because he's a little kid. So I had to get him out of there and it was already too late. So I'm bringing that up not to sort of decry all this and say it's bad, but to point out that there is I am familiar with the concept of physiological load that comes from experiencing these sorts of entertainments that are out there in the market today. And I'm sure that, I mean, there are physiological loads you can go through before. It's not, again, you know, I've never died from playing League of Legends in a Korean, you know, in a Korean internet cafe, but someone has, right? Like, so like it does happen. You can totally overdose on this stuff. But I think it was Korea. But anyway, I would say that the way that the VR design was headed was to counteract the overwhelm and the motion sickness by locating you in your physical space that you're currently in. And when I hear about the sort of virtual ergonomics of how to utilize these virtual workspaces, it seems like they're leaning on that concept. And so that, to me, is interesting because it sort of does elegantly solve all these problems. But it also kind of like it makes the VR kind of not as interesting. Because you, I mean, it's like, well, not as much of a change, because you have a screen in your room. You could put a screen in your room. Like, yes, ooh, now I don't have to put a screen in my room, and I can wave my hand, and it'll change everything, and I don't have to do it. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess putting up a projector is annoying. You know, and I know people can say it's not like that. I know it's better, but it's like, what are the things that are changing about this? And ultimately, for me, I haven't tried it again. Like, I played it. It was fun. I really enjoyed it. I was glad to get the chance to play it. I was really impressed by the quality of the experience and how the scanner scanned the room I was in and all the furniture that was in it and was able to kind of incorporate all that into the game was really impressive, probably more impressive than the game itself. And in that sense, it's different from the three-body problem. Because the way the three-body problem presents the VR is like it totally replaces the world that you're in with an imagination of a vast and totally different world. Like, you are literally on a green screen studio and they are making the whole show around you. And that is actually what is happening when they're making the show, right? Like,
You're in the volume, the Mandalorian volume, right? Where they actually project the set all around you. Okay. And it's different. Pete, you said it differs from the novels somewhat. Is it important to talk about the differences from the novels, or is it enough to say it differs from the novels somewhat?
It's hard to talk about without spoilers, so I won't go too much into it. The main thing being that I think it's interesting that in the show, the VR headset is given a very elegant and streamlined form factor, which it does not have in the books. Like, it's an elegant little gold thing that you put on your head and does this. And I think that there's a lot to be said for the VR hype. And all the hype, you know, all the hype that's happening.
All the great hypes.
I got my certificate, my professional certificate in digital marketing about 6 years ago. And in that, there was a required chapter, like there was like a required lecture and assignments of like, how are you going to use VR in marketing in the next couple of years?
Oh, that's hilarious. Were they calling it the metaverse then, Pete, or was it not?
No, that word had not even come around. We were several sausages before that one still, before that little sausage came up on the Barbie. But no, yeah, exactly. It was just like, well, are you using VR? And it's like, well, yeah, my company did a VR campaign. They did it once. It sort of worked, I guess. We didn't do it again. It was expensive. Right? Like, you got to set up a place where you do it. Not everybody's going to go to this place. So it was interesting that it was like, this thing is inevitably happening. You better get hype about it or you're not going to pass this course. And then to sit around for 6 years and only now is it sort of like starting to happen, for realsies, which I thought was interesting.
And even that is still borderline.
Right. But like part of the presentation of the immersive entertainment, and I would even expand this beyond VR, but feel free to talk more about VR, AR, whatever you want to call it. Not that the terms are interchangeable, but we're talking generally here. Part of the quality of immersiveness is the presentation. It's like a meal. It's like the way in which the immersiveness is presented to you affects the flavor of the immersiveness. You know, if your couch is part of the game, that feels different than if, you know, everything in the game is totally on an alien planet, right? And so the way that the barrier, or not the barrier, but like the way that the information that you would observe outside of the game system and the information that you observe within the game system relate to each other is part of the way in which you are being presented with the concept that this is like a virtual experience. And I think that you could talk about different sort of ways that this is put together and how it affects the game. Because like, there's only certain kinds of games that you would want to have your couch be in it. You know, a goofy, happy alien shooter. Sure. Like, and maybe I want to play Time Crisis and I duck behind my couch. That'd be super fun. You know, like there I am spending time in bowling alley video arcades again, movie theater video arcades. But like, you know, it feels like that constrains what you're doing in the game design. But it's not like game designers can't work through constraints. It's almost a gift at times, you know, I suppose. But I mean, Mark, did you feel more hyped up and more like, did your heart rate go up when you were being geared up even before the game started? Or did you like really get into gear when the game started?
It was more the latter. And like the context, you're right. That's a good one. It's an important thing there, right? Like, having aliens, you know, hovering above your couch is one thing. And then like, you know, having kind of the darkened room with the special effects and like a quote unquote briefing and things like that. Yeah, it does certainly prime the brain for it. It helps, but it's not the entire thing. But that's kind of like the fascinating draw of the virtual reality helmet is like you put it on And then you are, you know, for the, not the augmented reality, but the virtual reality thing, like you see in Three Body Problem, right?
Yeah.
You're instantly transported to a completely different context. It is completely, at its best, it is completely immersive. And really key as well, too, is like you are kind of shut off from other people as well. Like they're gone. The entire outside environment.
That's a really good
people
point.
Are totally gone. Yep. And I will contrast that, by the way, like with something that's immersive, but not a virtual reality thing, which is like a theme park ride. Right. Where, you know, in the queue, you know, you're in a different environment and, you know, they're playing videos and, you know, they get like, you know, it's like you're on the alien spaceship or whatever. Right. And then you get on the ride and you feel the wind and, you know, they shoot spray some water on your face and that sort of thing. But you still see, you know, you're still wearing your regular clothes. You still look like you, and you look over to, you know, the people that you came on the ride with, and they still look like they did, you know, before you entered into the ride area. We can go in a couple of different directions here on this, right? Like the analog theme park ride sort of thing, but the digital thing, like the isolation from other people, is really crucial to this idea of what makes virtual reality totally immersive entertainment what it is. It's lonely.
It reminds me, it makes me want to coin the like the Romano Tours principle of virtual reality. The more years go by, the more I feel like that one Saturday Night Live sketch is one of the more genius things that I've seen.
Wait, unpack that.
So there's a Saturday Night Live sketch with Adam Sandler, and he's playing basically Mario Perillo. You remember Mario Perillo? Yeah. Mr. Italy. So it's a series of local and regional television commercials that were big in like the 80s and 90s.
I remember Wario Perillo. Was that...
And he was basically a travel agent. He would basically sell you trips to Italy on the TV. Like you call him and then you could get like a week long trip to Italy and you go to these different places. And so there's one of these joke commercials, but the whole joke is him giving you a disclaimer because he's had a bunch of dissatisfied customers that if you're sad now, like when you go to Italy, you will also be sad, right? Like we can take you on a hike. We can't make you someone who likes hiking, right? We can put you on a roller coaster. We can't make you emotionally capable of sincerely saying the word we, right? Like, and it goes through, there's like various testimonials from couples who sort of get it versus don't get it. Like we went to the Vatican. It was great. We stayed for 20 minutes, went back to the hotel, watched Paddington 2. Paddington 2 is a blast. Yeah, I love that Paddington, right? Like, and it's like these guys had a great vacation because they didn't really like invest a whole lot in the fact that the vacation was going to change them, right? And so like but it has visual aids, it's very funny, and the whole concept, right, is like, yeah, your transportative experience doesn't change the fact that you bring yourself with you. And I think that VR opens an interesting possibility here, is your question here, or just entertainment and storytelling in general, because I don't want to discount the immersiveness of merely like reading a book or watching a TV show, because the human brain is very capable of immersion. At least I don't know about yours, but mine is. I don't need a VR helmet to like place myself into a book that I'm reading. Like I get very immersed in the book that I'm reading. I'm just sitting in a room with a book and it's like I'm in it, man. You know, like I friggin' played friggin' Cobra Triangle on the NES for months and months and months, and it's like a little motorboat going around a couple of curves, right? And it's like, oh, I'm so immersed in the motorboat. I'd have nightmares about falling into pits because my brain would get so fixated on the video games that I was playing on the 8-bit Nintendo systems. So like the brain's capacity for immersion is like one factor, but then also if the immersion of a book isn't enough, if the immersion of a movie isn't enough, and you're seeking this sort of greater degree of immersion, are you seeking a sort of greater monopoly over your sensation? You know, are you seeking a sort of story that occupies a sort of greater range of like sensory musics? You know, like, you know, we talked about Dunkirk. I finished Oppenheimer. I finally saw Oppenheimer, right? Like big movie on a big screen, you know, like, and everything that's happening all around you is not, it's not just to impress you with the size of it. It's part of the tools that are available to the storyteller, so it can do things that other stories can't do. But is there possibly part of it too where you kind of don't want to be there? Like take me somewhere where I'm not there, you know, like take me someplace where I get to be someone else, but not even that much, because you can do that from reading a book. But just like shut out all the people I know, put me in this kind of virtual environment. I mean, we could have the sort of little conversations about the Matrix and all that, but it's a little bit rudimentary, you know, or not rudimentary, but a little bit basic, to say like, well, you could be totally happy. Let's not even assume that. But it's sort of like, how much of your sensation can be invested in the simulation in order to what, reach, change, move your internal life? I mean,
is that the goal though?
I don't know. Well, like, in the three-body problem, it kind of is. Although I guess that's, I don't want to get too deep into what's going on. But the idea that, like, you impress upon people this, like, total transportative experience with this little golden headset.
They get them to do something very specific.
Yeah, and like, well, even more than that, it's like
world-changing.
They immediately know that, oh, when I'm with you, my world has changed, right? Like, oh, you're the aliens, right? Like, oh, man, this is different. This is something different than from what I have, right? Because the three body problem, you know, it's, and again, I don't want to spoil anything, but like, it starts out with somebody who's really unhappy with their life, right? Like, who's like, you know, the real world really sucks. And a lot of it, I think, explores some ideas about like how people respond to the idea of really, really not liking the world, and what they would do about it. And I think like be really drawn into a VR experience that gives you this total transportiveness is part of it.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking to be clear, we're talking about Ready Player One, right? You know, the
escapes the
dystopic world and puts in the thing. We probably did a podcast on
Ready Player One. Like, we're also talking about something else, and this was what I could bring. The only thing I could bring to the table on this episode, but then Pete beat me to it.
Oh, sorry.
Pete beat me to it.
You're going to talk about Adam Sandler and Saturday Night Live? Nope.
You mentioned Ashley Judd on Star Trek The Next Generation. And I wanted
I
wanted to refer everyone to the season 5 episode of Star Trek The Next Generation entitled The Game. You know, which is a little headset thing, very tiny, I suppose, virtual reality, or I suppose it's more accurate to say augmented reality, because when you look at it, you see it's superimposed over what the person is seeing, so it doesn't take over the whole perceptual field wholesale. It just, you know, sort of projects onto your eyes, and it has little discs. It's kind of a reverse whack-a-mole game in that you have little discs and they are sucked. They are vacuum tubed down into, they have little wormholes that open up and suck them down, suck the little flying discs down into the thing. And I mean, this is the game, and it's been a minute, but as I recall, it's a means of social control, right? Like it's a plot by someone who I think meets Commander Riker on Risa, which, as you recall, is the pleasure planet of the resort.
They're all pleasure planets. Go for a hike. We can't turn you into someone who likes hiking, though.
No, Pete, come on. We know from Star Trek and Star Wars, it has this in common, that every planet is one thing, right?
Yes.
Like Cyclops has the laser eyes, you know? Storm has the crashy, crashy thunder. And, you know... and so the pleasure planet of Risa, yes, and it infiltrates the Enterprise, and it's supposed to like take over Starfleet somehow, right? Like it's a opiate for the masses, type of situation that is supposed to like disconnect people from any desire to do anything pro-social or you know, adaptive or like anything that's good. And I forget exactly why we're taking over Starfleet in this particular episode, but you know, the world is saved by Wesley Crusher and Ashley Judd, no? Or does she fall to the game in the end?
I think she falls to the game.
She falls to the game and that's the final indignity, right? Like it's like, God, I thought you were cool. Now all you want to do is play this game. God, I'm gonna have to save the Enterprise again. Yeah, and that like I was thinking about this, you know, I don't know, when some of my perspective on this is having read some like I suppose earlier than now, Ray Kurzweil stuff in the 90s, you know, about the approaching singularity when I was a teenager, and even the most, asinine things seem, you know, kind of like earth shattering and groundbreaking. That's, I mean, like, you know, the singularity or libertarianism. And the whole thing that I remember was this, Ray Kurzweil description of like people living in matrix pods and sort of having their needs all met by artificial stimulus, you know, piped into their brains with these, he called them agents. I guess, you know, related less to the idea of agency per se, the philosophical idea of agency, and more to the Latin root of meaning, you know, doing, to do. So these were, they're like kind of doing entities, and one was like the companionship entity. Get your mind out of the gutter, you two. I guess you might want to find yourself in your own little three body problem, right there, and deliver a physiological load. Never mind. The whole thing was really isolating. It was really very kind of depressing, because it's a kind of to what end was my question, right? And like would it increase, you know, the sum total of human happiness, I guess, for us to be all in our matrix pods? But then like what about the rogue woman from the pleasure planet of Risa who wanted to take over Starfleet bio, and we were, you know, defenseless to stop her because we were all in our pleasure pods letting the discs get wormholed down into their little reverse whack-a-moles. I don't know. That is what I had to contribute to this. So basically, long story short, VR bad, and if you like it, you are bad.
I mean, that's not what we're saying. It's worth saying. It's the kind of thing you have to say out loud because you're being so bombarded with advertisement for it, you know, like that, various direct and indirect degrees. I feel like it's healthy in respect to a lot of these new technologies to remind yourself that they're bad, just because so much of the irrationality that you hear is about them being good. And so it can ground you a little bit, but just counterbalance it.
I think about it though. I mean, quite so flippant about it. I think about it like, I think we are all your son, Pete, like in the arcade, man. Like, yeah. There's too much stimulus. You know, it's not like the human organism, all the technology has evolved, but the human organism has not. Right, like the technology changes, the nature of the stimulus changes, or the kind of thoroughgoing immersive nature of the stimulus changes very rapidly, but the human organism does not change very rapidly, and we have seen what happens to, you know, we've seen like the kind of conditioned, I'm sorry, this is going to sound like it's taking a left turn, but it's really not. We've seen the kind of the phenomenon of sort of conditioned hyper eating emerge in first world populations, right? In developed world populations, in response to the environment of industrial abundance of food, right? And it's not good, right? Like the outcomes are not good. And it's part of the genius of capitalism that it turns its own ill effects into market opportunities. And so now we have a class of drugs that purports to take care of this, you know, whatever the word legitimate just completely misses the point. Like whatever their intended clinical purposes are, they're being marketed as a sort of solution to living in an environment of industrial hyperabundance. And I wonder what happens to the brain in an environment of industrial hyperabundance of stimulus?
It's a great question. Let me kind of take your example there and apply it to this technology paradigm we're talking about here, right? So, especially that part about how the crazy thing about capitalism, but will, you know, like, you know, create a bunch of problems and then create another market to fix those problems. which might be creating some different problems as well, too. Okay, so we're all familiar with the phenomenon now, right? Okay, we're talking about the abundance of stimuli, right? You're watching a show on your television, and the degree to which it's trying to immerse you can vary a lot, right? It can be like, you know, this very intense movie like Oppenheimer, where it really wants to make you feel like you're in Los Alamos and watching a freaking atomic bomb blow up in your face. It could be something much more casual, but like, you know, I don't know, like Love is Blind. Just for an example, put that out
there. Okay, sure.
Is it Cake season 3, which for some reason my 5-year-old put on, and I'm extremely annoyed that Netflix decided to recommend Is It Cake to a 5-year-old. So anyway, you're watching whatever.
We live in a world of abundance of cakes and cake-like objects.
Right? Yes. Right. There's no abundance. Anyway, so you're watching whatever on TV, and it can run the spectrum from Oppenheimer to Is It Cake. And what all of us often do, and many people do, right, is then like we'll flip through our phone while we're watching the thing we were purported to watch.
Yes.
Right? That's supposed to be picking up our attention. Right? Yeah, absolutely. Like, overabundance of stimuli. So the interesting thing about the virtual reality experience, you put a headset on, and putting aside the Apple Vision Pro thing where, like, you know, you have a computer, you know, set up there, and you can look at a bunch of windows, right? I'm talking about, like, put the headset on, and then, like, you're only, like, I don't know, watching a movie on an enormous screen in front of your face, or only, like, playing a game, like a fully immersive thing where you're shooting aliens or whatever, right? Like, the crazy thing is that that actually, like, you know, that's take the extreme of hyper simulating environment that's like completely 100% hijacked all of your input and is allowing you to focus on just one thing. Is there a parallel there? That's my question there, right? Am I onto something, guys? Or am I just
a parallel,
like,
between what? Sorry, can you articulate it more simply?
Oh, the Ozempic thing, where, like, you know, the hypercaloric environment, where it just kind of, like, you know, allows you to eat, and you're just kind of, you know, throwing this, and then, like, yeah, the capitalism then comes up with a solution, which is like, oh, here's this drug that allows you to, like,
but that was a vomitorium. Like,
you know, the vomitorium is actually, and I feel like the vomitorium is actually a more wholesome solution to the problem, right? Like, because I don't know. I think a lot of work still needs to be done on what is the class of drugs called? GLP-1 drugs, but they sort of alienate you from basic drives. And that is, I mean, how could that possibly go wrong? You know, only someone made an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation to explore the concept of just being, you know, kind of like alienated from any of the drives that you have to, like, you know, do sort of pro survival things in your life. Anyway, the vomitorium at least, like, you know, respects the idea that you like that eating is fun and great, and we like, you know, and we like to do it. So I'm being a little facetious, I guess, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, sorry, Pete. What were you saying about the vomitorium?
Well, okay. First of all, I mean, I always grate at the idea of people ascribing agency to capitalism as if it's this, like, salient entity, which it is not, right? Like, it is like a vast array of conditions. And also, Novo Nordisk made this stuff. Like, there's actual people who made it. It wasn't made by a ghost. But anyway, I want to put that aside for a second.
It also wasn't made by Frito-Lay.
But part of the idea, I think that reflects the notion of immersion and the shift to the notion of being a consumer rather than a worker. We don't even really think about the fact that a person actually had to do this. I mean, I think it relates to the three-body problem and the idea that the headset comes from aliens. Well, I mean, there's a person on Earth who has to actually make it. But, like, this idea that it sort of just arrives for you, right? And this is sort of part of the story.
I think of capitalism.
Somebody had to make it, you know.
I think, like, of capitalism like the spider in the South Park episode about the about Catholicism. Do you remember that, where suddenly, like, everyone starts chanting, you know, and like St. Peter's, and like the big spider comes out, and then it turns out that the spider gives everything about gives all, you know, Catholic doctrine and dogma. Like, as a Catholic, I appreciated that a slightly malevolent giant spider was actually saying everything that I
yes.
believed.
So a medieval conspiracy theory has motivated your modern social theory.
And that is capitalism. It's, you know, there's a spider. There's like a, you know what I mean? Like a Baron Harkonnen looking kind of a floating blob somewhere that just wills things into existence, right, of its own accord.
So I think the way I would approach it is to think about this paradigm of problem and solution as things that exist outside of the experience of subjective reality, right? Like the person who's doing it, the person who's involved in it, and also outside of a faculty of regulation, a personal faculty of emotional regulation, being like very important for all of these things. And you run into a problem, of course, which is sort of a problem of scale, wherein on a small scale, you in a situation where your only option is to exercise some form of personal regulation, directly or indirectly, generally indirectly, right? Like exercise some sort of indirect regulation of your environment to create an intervention into your behavior, because you know that as a human being and not as a sort of robot, you don't actually fully make conscious choices to do things. You kind of respond to stimulus that's happening around you. I'm talking about, like, you can't let Oreos in the house if you're going to eat the whole sleeve of Oreos, right? So, like, you have to exercise some sort of form of regulation. But the regulation has to be sophisticated, because the pressure that is on a large scale and a statistical scale is so large, and the behavioral response is kind of predictable at a large scale. And so it's like, well, you know, if you can't really, like, there's really no way to stop a person from eating Oreos. Like, it really is impossible. And it's like, well, if it's you and your best option has a low success rate, you probably just go with your best option anyway. But I guess what I'm suggesting here is that the creation, so the individual interacts with this sort of access. And in this case, I think we're talking about what? I mean, I guess we're saying immersion. A sort of sensory consumption, a sort of greater and greater share of sensory experience in a sort of like ramping up of the creation of simulation, right? To a point where you kind of feel sick all the time, or you kind of feel like you're not attending to your other needs, right? And you're sort of getting sick, and you should exercise some sort of regulation over yourself. Like, for example, not working in a VR headset every day, which, by the way, write that book now. Put it in a safety deposit box and tell someone to mail it to a publisher under a pseudonym in 5 years, and right. You'll have a New York Times bestseller in 5 years, as it's like use a monitor, the hot new tip, right? Like, you know, how can I get away from my overall consuming distraction in my virtual office environment? It's like, well, what you do? No, but you need to constrain it. You know?
It needs Pete a catchy name, like the Pomodoro, you know,
yeah.
Right? Like, which is like,
tomato?
How do you, yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. Like how do I keep from getting distracted? Well, you know, set a timer for 20 minutes and work on one thing for 20 minutes. When the timer goes off, you can take a break. Okay. that's basic. And that is not defensible IP at all. No. It's the Pomodoro. Oh my God! Let's make this man a billionaire. You know.
So, I would suggest, I think, as a dynamic also here, is that the trick, the sort of ultimate trick, I think, is that your brain knows what you're doing, even if you don't. You know. So even if you don't know that you're eating way too much, your brain does, and it's not happy with you, and you're not going to be happy. You know, and like there's parts of your brain that are going to be aware of the imbalances that are happening. And that's not like they render judgment. I'm not talking about your superego, but like that you have degrees of subconscious awareness of things that are happening to you, whether they are semantic or sensation. But it's something like VR. The more therapy I've gone to over the years, the more I've kind of felt like the Matrix question is inadequate. And again, it's like, well, if you knew it were a Matrix, it wouldn't feel like it was real. And it's like, no, it would be so much worse than that. If you knew that you were in the Matrix, you would be constantly rationalizing and like reforming justifications or phantoms about like what's really happening in your life, right? Like, if you were in a matrix and you knew you were in a matrix, like, you might become, like, inexplicably angry at the Red Sox, right? Like, and never know why, because there's, like, this very key piece of information about your life that is in your brain somewhere, right? And is being, and you are thwarting it. You are thwarting your ability to kind of process it and understand it by, like, deliberately taking up your attention. And it's not just with the sort of deviation of your attention to other things, but with the stimulation that accompanies all this stuff, right? Like that we've talked about, just the sense of arousal can really get in the way of reflection, you know? And so I would be concerned. And again, we're jumping all the way from, like, I played a game shooting aliens for 10 minutes at my sister's house on Christmas, and it was fun, to this idea that, like, this is going to consume your entire life to the point where you're going to be incapable of regulating yourself. And you're going to use it as a crutch. You're going to use it as a point of regulation for feelings that you don't know how to tolerate. And I mean, that, I did that with Team Fortress 2. Like, I don't need VR to do that, right? Like, and I think that this is I don't know if I'm doing a great job of articulating it, but I do think the three-body problem and Oppenheimer are both somewhat related to it. When you think about, like, Los Alamos as it's presented in the story, as this, it's an Ozempic. Los Alamos is an Ozempic. Can I use that as a generic term now? Can we gradually erode the trademark of Ozempic by using it as a general term for a corrective for a problem you made yourself? Or, like, not made yourself, like, you know what I mean? Like,
wait. Unpack that idea of Los Alamos being the Ozempic.
So in the end of Oppenheimer, so spoilers for Oppenheimer, he builds an atomic bomb.
Right? Felt, like, really bad. Not himself, felt really bad about it.
In a cave with a box full of scraps. Right? Like, no, he takes billions of dollars and many, many scientists and other associated workers and experts to do it. But in order to do this work, they had to build this town in the middle of New Mexico. We didn't have to, but he chose to do it because New Mexico is kind of his happy place. And it was convenient to where the railroads might potentially intersect to kind of bring components from different places so that you could maintain kind of compartmentalization of different parts of the project on various railroads, ship things all in secret to this sort of junction. And in the junction, you would have to put a town because you can't recruit people to the town if they don't bring their families, right? It's like, I can't get the best nuclear physicists if they would have to leave their wives in order to join me, right? Like, they have to bring their families with them. And so he creates this town that exists for the purpose of this work. And he likes it a lot because he likes New Mexico and he likes being outdoors and he likes the feeling of it and the sort of this the sky and the earth and everything. And there's this scene near the end of the movie where he's giving the speech to the people of Los Alamos about the drop of the atomic bomb on Japan, right? And he is fully dissociating at this point, right? Like, he is like, this is a big IMAX experience. I'm watching it on a plasma screen TV, but it's still, like, big screen. I get the idea. And, like, things are sort of shaking and he's dissociating. Like, he is thinking about the implications of this weapon being used on human beings. Prior to that, he had found ways to kind of, like, wrestle with that and kind of find it to be necessary. But now it is, like, roaring in his ears that this has really actually happened. And he announces it, and everybody is cheering. And he looks around the room, and there's this sort of Americana, right? Richard Feynman, played by Dennis Quaid's son from The Boys, is, like, right there in the front, right? And it's all down home cherry pie and whatnot. And everybody is really happy. And of course they're happy. Like, that's why they're there. They're there to have accomplished this task, right? Like, this town of Los Alamos has been created as a social environment, a sort of stimulative environment, you know, to enable this particular work to happen. And all of its relationships and all of its kind of emotional context, you know, is in a sort of regulative state. It is trying to kind of, like, it's taking up a regulative role so that people aren't really, really wrestling with what they're doing. They're just doing it. You know, like, it's like, it's not really helpful if you're going to do this. And this is sort of what the Robert Downey Jr. character is talking about in Oppenheimer, to the extent that what he's saying is defensible, which is, like, you know, Oppenheimer managed the project that built the atomic bomb. He can feel bad about it as much as he likes, but he still did it, right? And so, you know, Strauss is very unsympathetic to Oppenheimer's like later attempts, and he doesn't think they're done in good faith to like conduct arms control and stuff. And I think you could say that his attempts to do arms control seem to have been done very much in good faith. But let's assume, and let's deal with it more with the idea of like, you know, he built this thing. He's really, really feels bad about the role that he had into it. And he built a happy place for himself where this work could happen to sort of anticipate and countermand that emotional processing of what he's done. And he sort of did it in advance and only realizes after the fact the degree to which it's like totally inadequate to the task that he put it to. Right? Like, I'm going to build this place. It's going to be my dream because it's going to combine nuclear physics. And it's going to be a totally immersive entertainment and science experience, like Los Alamos. Right, like I like all the buildings will be real, and what's, you remember the first thing that Emily Blunt says when she walks into the house, and she's like, she says this person has six fingers. No, she says there's no bathroom or there's no kitchen. Right, so it's like, oh, these are like facsimiles of homes that are built as an immersive experience for the scientists who are and engineers who are working at Los Alamos, and he realizes at the end that this Ozempic that he's created it is not going to be enough, that he's going to have to do more, that he's going to have to do something else, or that he's also going to have to be tortured. This is going to have to be something that he deals with.
Like get some work done, or, you know.
Well, like Olestra. Olestra is the better example. Do you remember Olestra?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, you remember Olestra for two words, and I can tell you exactly what words they are. I don't know if I want to say them on the podcast.
Not on the podcast.
Mark, do you remember Olestra?
The second one,
unfortunately,
is,
yes.
The second one is leakage. But the first one, let's not say. This is not, I mean, I was thinking, Pete, that this is not a new problem. And I am led, as I am so often led, Pete, I am led to reflect upon Romans 7.
Yeah, how often do you think of the Roman Empire?
I think of
Paul's only when I read the epistles of Paul. Yeah, exactly.
I think about Paul's letter to the Romans
so daily.
I think Romans chapter 7 verse 19. I think about a lot, actually. It is a like really pithy articulation of one of the problems of being alive. Romans 7, chapter 19, for the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do. That's it. Okay, that's all. That's the entire thing. I'm sorry. I can read a more contemporary translation.
No, it's not better with a contemporary. Everyone's chasing the better translation.
I do not do the good thing I want, but the evil thing I do not want, that's the thing I do. And Paul goes on to say, oh, wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? And I actually think that the thing about virtual realities, and this doesn't necessarily apply to Oppenheimer, but maybe it does in a weird way. Like, the thing about virtual realities is that they are incorporeal, and so they are kind of immortal, right? Like, they don't have the stink of decay on them. They don't have kind of the stink of mortality, on them. But I think that they don't necessarily, solve the problem, right? Like, I think they're no Ozempic in search of an Olestra. You know, that's the problem, right? Like, because the question is not, I don't know, like, or at least like anything that promises you to deliver you from your mortal body that is not God is a lie, right? Like is, you know, is not actually,
the hottest take of the podcast. Right? Like, yes.
It's not going to work. And you know what? That statement holds for atheists also. You actually don't have to be a theist to believe that. You just have to believe that nothing in the world can actually deliver you from having to live in the world, right? And sort of deal with, right? Like, I'm sorry, maybe I should read Romans chapter, Romans 7 chapter, verse 20, chapter 7, verse 20, which is that, now, if I do the thing that I would not, it's no more me that's doing it. I'm just translating. I'm freewheeling it now. I'm just making it up as I go. It's not me that's doing it, but the sin that, that dwelleth in me, right? And like, unless you sort of are willing to kind of contend with the corruption of your will by, you know, you can call it sin. I mean, that moralizes it in a way that might not always be totally helpful, but, you know, if you're not willing to get to contend with the kind of the corruptible nature of your will, you know, like, I don't know, you can throw all the virtual realities, you can throw all the Ozempics you want at it, but like the Yiddish vampire said when confronted with the cross, vil nicht gehelfen, it ain't gonna help you. You know, that's the vampire's gonna sink its teeth in, anyway. Who knew we would end up here in the epistles of Paul when we started in remembrance of Earth's past.
There's a Yiddish vampire in Paul, in the Epistles of Paul.
Yes.
I missed that.
He's talking about his anti-Catholic spider book that he bought. It's Yiddish vampires, and it talks about the grand world conspiracy and capitalism and all that other good stuff.
Yeah, it's, you know, the South Park, right?
It is really funny.
The big anti-Catholic conspiracy theory.
It is. I really want somebody to look at this from the perspective of how much of what happens in the three-body problem has Matt Rather described without knowing that that's what he's been describing while he's been talking about it.
I love that. It's one of those things, Pete. Like, I'm such a completist that I have I really hesitate to start things that I know I'm going to want to finish. You know, that there's going to be a pull to finish. Or maybe this is my just undiagnosed or rather self-diagnosed, attention issues. Just pinging around thoughts pinging around in my brain, like flying discs getting sucked down into a reverse whack-a-mole type of situation. Right. But I just don't want to, like, I downloaded it. I don't know. Look, if you know what you're doing, if you know how to open the dev tools on your browser, you can make a, let's call it an archival copy of what you get from Libby. And it's good because sometimes you want to listen to an audiobook, but you can't bring yourself to want to listen to the audiobook until after the 3-week window of the loan period has expired. So like I am prepared to dive into the three body problem, the series of novels first, but I haven't yet. But if I've described it well myself, then I don't even need to read it, and I can move on to the next impossible goal that I have in my life.
Like so many goals, you have to divide it up into small pieces and take it one bit at a time, right? Like if you're thinking about there's a fourth book that's like fan fiction that I don't think you have to read. You can start narrowing it down. You can map it out. You can, I don't know. I'm just trying to like help you cope with the difficult things in life, such as whether to read an entire sci-fi, like relatively hard sci-fi series that spans many, many, many years and all that other stuff. Yeah. I can't deal with it. It's one of the places where I went down the YouTube lore rabbit holes. And so I know what happens. And I had nightmares for weeks because of, and again, that's not a spoiler. The story goes on for many, 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 many years. So there's like lots that happens. So don't take my reflection as a description of any particular event. But yeah, it's, people say it's good and I'm scared of it. So I don't read it. But Mark is watching it and he's getting in there. And it is interesting that we react with such fierce ferocity against the idea that VR is going to take over our lives when it has not really asked to quite yet. But it is like, it's like we know that were we to get it, you could go really deep on it, right? That's the fear. That it's like we know that about ourselves. That if I were to get something like this, I would use it all the time and it would be really bad.
Yeah, it's really, like, you know what? It's kind of like AI, right? Like all the fear mongering around AI. The problem is not that AI is so good. It's that we are so stupid. And that's, Right? And that's the problem. You know, yeah. That's a kind of a much scarier thing to contemplate than the idea that, like, oh, you know, I don't know, the technology is going to replace novelists, you know? I mean, like, imagine if it could, you know, a human mind can only contemplate the 3-body problem. But if the AI wrote books, it would be like the 28-body problem. It would be the 57-body problem. There would be too many problems. Two bodies, two problems. The sequel to the body and the problem. Guys, we're getting punchy. It's time to wrap
this
up.
You've been punchy since the jump, but probably me too. I think we all been a little punchy today. But yeah, it's bodies and problems, man. That's just how it goes.
We had a rainy day today in Los Angeles. We've gotten more rain than Seattle year to date, which is not the way it's meant to be. It's not how our climatological zone here is supposed to work. So anyway, little stir crazy probably, but thank you, everyone.
It sounds like Matt's avoided to escape from the dreariness. He should slip on a VR helmet and go someplace sunny and shoot some aliens.
Take a load off, man. You should either get a VR helmet or a hot tub.
It's a game.
One of those killed Matthew Perry. I forget which one it was.
I found it on oh gosh.
Sorry, that's too dark.
Thank you for listening to us be punchy and stir crazy. Thank you very much.
Don't immerse yourself in your hot tub. It's not for immersion.
Thank you, Pete and Mark, for podcasting with me. We'll be back next week with more Overthinking It podcast, now in VR. Until then, you can visit us on the web at overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.
Use a monitor.